are we doing, exactly? Scully is once more holding the bulb above her head in the dank basement room beneath my office. Her face is cast in shadows as she pulls her hair out of her face and swallows nervously. I went to the beach last night. I say and give the pulley another churn. The two bodies combined are far heavier than sit alone, and it's taking me quite a bit of time to pull them up to us. I heard what happened to Sid, and I'm really not sure I want to see him like that. Scully adds, but doesn't make any attempt to move away. I pause for a moment, and then give the crank another rotation with as much force as I can muster. I'm not here to show you Sid. I'm here to show you someone who looks far worse, I think, but I don't say it. I just hope she can hold it together when I pull the burnt man topside.
Then who are you showing us?
Colin sounds weary. Not afraid, but there's hesitation in his voice. I went to the beach last night, I repeat, and one of the lights of Gara, well, it turns out they're not just lights, they're these big metal things, or I don't know, almost stone-like birds. They have wings, but the wings don't flap or anything. Right now, I sound like the Wilson brothers' crazy Aunt Kathleen, I imagine.
Because it's made of stone.
Jacob says, the same weariness edging into his voice as in his brother's. Yes, and it has a little room in the middle. I have to lean all my weight into the pulley now to rotate the handle. No one makes any attempt to help me. My arms ache, and goddammit, I'm tired. Why aren't they getting this? It's a weird bird-shaped-like thing with wings that don't move, and there's a little room where the bird body should be, and this guy was in it last night. And when I went and got him and brought him back here, my words come out all at once, but I just need someone else to see what I saw. Oh, and he's dead. Obviously he's dead, because we're down here. The cloth I threw over both of the bodies last night comes into view.
What do you mean when you got him?
Jacob looks at me, his eyes narrow.
Where did you get him from?
I may. I inhale sharply and gesture to Colin to help me pull the plank up next to the top of the well. The sheet is covered in icy crystals that formed underground in the freezing air below. I may have, kind of, gone into the Forbidden Zone after the bird thing exploded in the sky and crash-landed there. I start pulling back the white sheet.
You what? You went into the Forbidden Zone? Are you trying to get yourself killed?
Jacob is livid, and I can't really blame him. I turn around to face them. Look, it's just where this thing happened to be heading. I don't think the guy inside had any control anymore. The entire thing was on fucking fire. I'm sorry if this put me in danger, but if I'm being honest, I didn't really think about it. I just wanted answers. I was just trying to figure out why Gara is so fucking angry and has decided to maybe starve us all, so I'm sorry, but I thought this might give us some answers.
Good job, Sheriff.
Colin sounds like he's about to crack up laughing, but not in a good way. We all stare to look at him.
I mean, Gara is probably never going to forgive us now, but I'm glad you collected a clue.
He rubs his face, and a strange, drawn-out laugh escapes him. Colin? I didn't think he would be against me, but now that I've actually explained what I did to get the body, I can see that it was a bit reckless. Well, it's too late now, okay, everyone? So, Scully, can you just bring the light over here and we can all just look at him? I just need someone else to see this. Just, I feel like... I trail off as she gets closer. The man's dark hair has frosted over at the tips. The other three fall silent as we stare down at him. The strange garment he wears looks even more eerie, more real in the light of the bulb, compared to what I saw in the soft moonlight of the forest.
He's human,
Colin says gently,
but he's not like us. His clothes.
I take a step forward and feel the front of his chest. Under the bright light, I can see that the metal down his front is shaped like teeth, and that they are woven against each other, as if biting his shirt shut. Scully inhales deeply. But then she steps next to me and feels the fabric as well, runs her fingers down the metal teeth, then along the man's chest. "It's like nothing I've ever felt," she says, turning to me. "It's like squishy, but tough at the same time." That's not the only thing that's weird about him. I run my fingers along his arm until I reach his right hand and turn it over. The palm of his hand and the tips of the man's fingers glint in the light of the bulb, like shiny metal petals built into his skin.
"What's wrong with him?"
Jacob says, and now he, too, steps forward beside Scully, letting his shoulder touch hers as if to root himself in time and space. Jacob gently pokes the shiny palm of the man with his forefinger.
"It's cold," he says.
Then out of nowhere, the palm of the man shines a red light at us, dim, then it disappears.
"This is too much."
Colin is standing somewhere behind us.
"Is this Gara? I mean, what is this? He looks human, but he's not. Clearly, he's not. There's clearly something very wrong with him. That's probably why he was in the Forbidden Zone. And honestly, I think that's where he should have stayed."
"He talked to me," I say to Colin without turning around.
"And I didn't understand what he was saying, but he was very, very much human. I watched him die, Colin. So please, don't say he wasn't human. That's so cruel."
The three of us, Scully, Jacob, and me, wait for Colin to step beside us and join us. But instead, we hear his footsteps, angry stomps, as he makes his way back up into the law office.
"I'll talk to him," Jacob says. "Colin, he doesn't like it when things get complicated. But I'll talk to him at the house, and I'm sure he'll come around. But what do we do about..."
We look down at the burnt man's body. Jacob is still gently churning the lek box, and Scully is still holding up the bulb above our heads, shaking ever so slightly.
"Honestly, I don't know. I just wanted someone else to see it. See him. I have this feeling like, well, for one, that I was going crazy, but also that this, he, is just going to disappear, and I can't explain why. I just needed someone else to see that he is real."
"Someone might be looking for him," Scully says. "I'm sure he has a family somewhere."
"Somewhere," I echo.
"Until then, Sid is the only one that will keep him company, and we haven't even found his family yet."
"We will,"
Jacob says, like he believes it to be true.
"Tomorrow, we'll catch the berry thief, and maybe some of this will start to make sense."
The original plan was for Colin and myself to stake out the thief alone, but with Colin's change in mood, I don't argue with Jacob inviting himself. I pull the white cloth back over the body of the burnt man and lower him back into the ground. Then the three of us slowly make our way up the stairs and into my office. I tell Scully and Jacob that I'll see them in the morning, and they head out. Then I walk into the front room of the law office and look around. Kitchenware, bedding, and random family paintings, all from Sid's house, cover every surface of the office, waiting to be logged the next day. When we'll find the time to do this, I have no idea. I doubt even more that there's any sort of clue hidden anywhere among it.
What a mess.
I sigh into the room, and then I head out and home with Moon. Prudence is in bed when I go to see her. Scully's mother, Rita, is making her some hot brew out back by the fire pit when I walk in, and I sit down beside her, happy to have my Prue to myself for a few moments.
"How's crime, kid? Catch the bad guy yet?"
Despite the circumstance and Prudence's pale face, I can't help but smile.
"No, not yet, Prue. Honestly, I'm not sure I'm going to crack this one. Too many moving parts."
"How many?" she demands. I try to count them in my head. Old Rainier's cooking pot, if you can count that. Sid being dead. The burnt man on top of Sid. Abe getting shot. The berry thief. 4 or 5. I lift my chin and suck my teeth. "Make it 5, actually, because why not?" Prudence smiles at me.
"I'm sure you'll figure it out," And if you don't, then, well, no one could figure it out anyway, and it was plain unsolvable. You have too much confidence in me. I smile, but I feel a little defeated around the edges. Prudence tries to say something, likely something meant to cheer me, but a coughing fit takes hold of her instead, and I rifle through her covers to find her white pocket square. By the time I find it and go to hand it over, blood is spilling through Prudence's fingers, wet and slippery, and I want to say something, but all my words get stuck in my throat. Prue? I finally croak out, but she can't reply, grabs the white square of cloth from me, and simultaneously tries to clean her fingers of the blood while covering her mouth as tiny droplets spew onto the blanket before her. Oh, Prudence, I told you to take it easy. Rita looks at me with a hint of accusation, and I stand up from the bed. I'll go fix dinner, I say, and back out of the room slowly.
We'll all starve.
Prudence manages to choke out. It's supposed to be a joke, but just as the words leave her mouth, another coughing fit makes her entire body spasm, and I turn and almost run out of the room.
There, there,
I can hear Rita say to Prudence, as if Prudence is her child, and I think that it should be me taking care of Prudence, but I'm not sure I have it in me. She's taken care of me for most of my life. It's unbearable to watch her be weak, and it's cruel of me to think this, but the thought sits in my head, immobile, even as I run back to my hut and start cooking dinner. What I produce isn't good by any measure, but it's edible, and so we eat it. Rita, given Prudence's declining condition, has decided to stay the night. A bedroll is laid out beside her mattress on the floor. When I leave, I wish them both a good night. Then I lie in my own bed and listen to Prudence hacking away, followed by Rita's cooing and giving her things to calm her back to sleep, allowing me to sleep for a little while until it all repeats itself again. When the time comes to churn out the morning gospel, Prudence is just being lulled back to sleep once more, and my body feels like it's been filled with rocks. I churn out the gospel with my eyes closed and crawl back into bed for a few minutes. Then I remember how upset Colin was, and I force myself awake. By the time I get to the diner, all three of them are already sitting at the table I usually only share with Colin. Colin still looks disgruntled but demure. Whatever Jacob said to him must have worked, because he doesn't bring up the burnt man, and instead we eat our breakfast in peace. When we are finished, and before Perry can put the moves on Della, who is sitting alone at the counter, Abe must still be at home recovering from his gunshot wound, we ask James and Perry over to let them know that today we plan on catching the berry thief. We're thankful to learn that he hasn't been back.
So it's pretty likely he'll strike again today,
I say while trying to loose a berry seed from in between my front teeth.
He doesn't usually wait this long, so I'd say today is the day.
James agrees. I mean, of course, that was our strategy all along. I catch Colin's eye, and he gives me a weak smile. If he keeps up this downtrodden sad sack routine, I may lose my temper, I'm afraid. But I suppose, as long as he does his job, I'll give him time to regain his former self.
So you have a plan?
James asks.
You don't think anyone will get shot, do you?
He whispers the word shot under his breath and eyes Della, who is sitting at the counter with an earshot. He doesn't want to upset her after Abe was just shot, and I'm starting to think he's more or less a pacifist. I make no promises, I'm afraid. I shrug at James. We need to put an end to this, and if it comes to it... I raise my palms as if to say, then it fucking comes to it. James nods.
Well, I hope it doesn't.
I don't disagree, and I hope that my hunch about the thief and the thief's horse is correct. Otherwise, my plan won't work, and we will never get the guy, and he will continue to smoke us in any chase we dare enter with him. After breakfast, we head out towards the farms and put my plan into motion. Scully and Jacob are the decoy officers. I realize, as we talk over breakfast, that this makes far more sense anyway. If the thief sees two law officers go inside the barn, they know they've got a clean path of escape.
The fields that surround the barn are wide open. Colin and I stand far away, hidden behind some bushes, and watch as Scully and Jacob, not more than two dark dots from this far away, move towards and disappear through the entrance of the barn. I shrug my shoulders to my ears as a cold gust of wind whips across the field to where we are sitting on our horses.
You still mad at me?
I level at Colin, ready for a fight. He looks away from me, across the wide fields, towards the dense forest on the other side of the field.
I'm not mad at anyone.
Well, you're something, so just get it out. He turns, and he really doesn't look angry. He looks like someone kicked a foal right in front of him.
I'm just worried, Harper. I'm worried all the time. I'm worried about Jacob, and I'm worried about you, and you two not getting along. And ever since Dad died, I'm just so...
He trails off. Worried? I add, helpfully.
Yeah.
Colin draws in a breath.
And you always go looking for trouble, Sheriff. You always goddamn go looking for it, like you can't even help yourself.
There's no way anyone saw me that night, Colin. I try to argue, but he just sighs deeply.
I know that. But if it's not this time, then next time, or the time after that, I wish you didn't take every risk you come across.
Not how I'm built, Colin. You know that. Colin looks back towards the trees and sighs again.
Yeah, I know that. And so did Dad.
For now, we leave it at that. We try to get Moon and Trapper to acknowledge each other in a game we like to call See That Horsey Right Beside You, but neither of them gives in, and they continue to ignore the other. When the sun hits its zenith, the cloud clears for the first time in what feels like forever. The sun glints across the frosted fields and makes the leaves on the trees look golden, sparse as they are.
You think this is gonna work?
Colin asks after Trapper has decidedly ignored Moon for the 10th time.
If it doesn't, we're in a world of trouble. The way that rider moves, it's unnatural. A lot of things we come across are these days,
Colin says, but the bitterness in his voice has vanished.
I wonder what that red light in the man's hand is for.
So do I. I stare over at the barn, toy-sized in the distance.
I don't think we're ever going to find out, honestly. Yeah, probably not.
Colin stares over at the barn, too.
Hey, isn't that the horse?
Draped in a white sheet, we can see a large shape slowly wandering across the frosted field.
I'll be damned!
I hiss.
It is a goddamn ghost horse.
And it's Ghost Rider,
Colin adds. We're well hidden behind dense bushes, and far too far away from the barn for the rider to see us. We can see the figure dismount, but just barely a dark brown dot. Then the tiny figure melds with that of the barn, and Colin and I wait, back straightened, ready for the hunt. We don't have to wait long. Soon, we can hear angry screams echo across the field.
You son of an illegal breeder! I'm gonna...
We can hear James bellow and cut off John's from outside the barn. He's playing his part perfectly. Then, the large dark brown horse takes off like a shot. The sheet flails behind it like a giant tail.
Must have lost the sheet last time.
Colin grumbles. You ready? I ask him, and he nods. My leg muscles tense, and I push my heels down. We can see Jacob and Scully coming out of the barn on horseback, trying to catch the rider. But it's clear even from all the way over here that they are no match for this horse as it tears across the giant field and towards us. Time to change the race itself. The rider is coming closer now. We can make out the horse clearly. Its leg muscles pumping hard, its chest strong and barrel wide. Colin hits Trapper with his heels and off they go, out into the middle of the field. For a moment, we can see the rider. A head pops up from the smooth back of the giant horse, hair whipping in the wind, dark and wild. The rider makes a strange sound, and the horse tries to cut to the right, trying to stay on the even field. But then I give Moon a swift kick and take off, cutting the horse and the rider off, forcing them to head towards the trees, to their left, instead. Both Colin and I are still a ways away from the horse, and I can see it slow, considering turning back around. But Scully and Jacob are now coming up the rear, and we have formed a half circle around them that even our horses can cover quickly enough, considering there are four of us. It's like I can see the rider trying to calculate their next move. Slowing, slowly being forced back against the tree line. Go into the goddamn forest, I think. Go on now. No horse that big can run well, unless it has space to move. Open fields, grassland, we don't stand a chance. But our horses are smaller, more nimble. They're used to maneuvering around roots and fallen branches, through brush and beneath low-hanging trees. We move closer towards the rider, and I realize that it's not a man, but a woman. For a second, we lock eyes, hers dark and feral, mine sea-green and calm now. I can see the split decision play across her face, and a sharp "hee-ya!" escapes her mouth. Her horse bounds towards the woods. She's going to try to take us on our own turf. As she turns, I can see the two parcels of berries strapped to her saddle beneath the sheet. All four of us span out as we tear after her. 5 horse lengths between us, we rake across the field and towards the woods. Even though I promised James I would try not to use my gun, I touch it, just to feel it at the ready. I don't think this woman is going down without a fight, even though I hope otherwise. Leaves crackle and branches snap beneath us as all four horses enter into the forest at once. I'm lucky enough to be close to a trail I know well, and Moon instinctively starts following it, faster than she's ever run through the forest before. Good girl. The sheet is still billowing in the wake of the thief's horse, making her an easy target. The combined gnashing of brush the horses are causing as we gallop in a tight line is thunderous. I'd be terrified if I was her. We ride on, the white sheet peeking out from behind a tree or a bush every once in a while, marking the thief. But it's not like she has anywhere to go. The forest goes on for miles, and this time, we are the ones that are catching up to her, and fast. The sheet, at first, only appears and flickers ahead of us, but soon we can see it trailing ahead of us continuously. Then we can actually make out the rider. The hood of her dark-colored shirt has fallen away to reveal dark, bounding curls. Her looks are panic-stricken as she turns around to face us every once in a while, trying to loosen the sheet that's become entangled around the back of the saddle amidst the parcels. A few times, I get so close to her on the trail that I can almost reach out and grab the sheet, but then we lose our mark. She pulls away a second time, but then she finally comes to a stop and raises her hands without turning around. Her chest, as is mine, heaves from the exertion.
"Don't kill me,"
she says, her voice strangely stilted and lilting at the same time.
"What did she just say?"
Jacob, who is riding to my left, is making his way through the trees towards me. His gun is raised. "She said, don't kill me." I reply, but I, too, draw my weapon. "Get off the horse. Now." I cock my gun for emphasis. The tiny woman slides off the giant horse. "Now turn around," I tell her. Both Colin and Scully are drawing up the flanks and join Jacob and myself as we watch the woman turn to face us. Dark curls fall well below her shoulders. She glares at us with dark eyes. Annoyance flickers through them, not fear. Like we've foiled her plan, but that this is only a temporary hindrance. "What's your name?" I trot closer, my gun still leveled at her head. For a moment, it looks like she won't reply, so I point the gun down at her chest and back up at her face. "Name?" I say again.
"Marnie."
Well, that's not a name I've ever heard before. I throw my leg over Moon's neck and slide off her, not once taking my gun off the tiny woman. With my left hand, I start to unhook my cuffs from my belt. Marnie's coming with us. Where are you from, Marnie? She doesn't answer me, but looks over towards the fields, to the west. The Forbidden Zone is to the west.
I don't think she's going to tell us.
Jacob calls out to me, and I stand behind Marnie and tighten the cuffs around her wrists.
Well, she'll have some time to think about it, won't she?
We tie her horse to Moon's saddle. It's surprisingly docile, given the fight it's put up to avoid capture. I make Marnie walk alongside us until we are back on the road, and then I let her mount the saddle behind me. Her tiny body is close to mine. The top of her head comes up to my shoulders. She smells like someone who hasn't washed in the river for a long time. There are undertones of moist earth and dried flowers, but her sickly sweet body odor is so overpowering that I have to lean forward to not gag. I will have to arrange to let her have some time in the river, cold as it may be. When we get to the station, Marnie looks around and then at us like we're crazy. Sid's belongings are scattered everywhere, and I can't say I blame her.
Jacob, can you take her to the holding cell?
Sure thing, Sheriff.
He says and starts to walk over. Then he stops. We both stare at the ground for a moment before we look up at each other. Jacob hasn't called me Sheriff in at least 2 years. He did for the first year, and then something happened that made him stop.
Great. Thank you.
I don't add deputy to the end of the sentence. Best not to push my luck. When Jacob gets closer to our prisoner, I can see his expression change to one of disgust.
We'll have to arrange for some river time.
I murmur as they pass us, and Jacob just nods while Marnie shoots me an angry look.
I could bring her a change of clothes tomorrow, Scully offers. She looks to be closest to my size, and I don't think she's from around here and has any extra things to wear.
That would be great, Scully, I say, and watch Jacob as he leads the tiny woman into the empty cell and locks the door behind her. Marnie looks after him through the bars and starts to lean back and forth.
Can you take these off?
Her accented words throw me, even though I heard her speak earlier. It's like her mouth forms a square every time she pronounces a vowel. I take the keys from Jacob and walk over to her. Hey, look, I know you're not from here, or from anywhere near here, but things would go a lot easier for you if you just told us where you're from and why you've been stealing from the Berry Farm.
Berry Farm,
Marnie says, as if it's a new concept. Then she adds, as if it's the most obvious thing,
I steal because we're hungry.
We? For a moment, I wonder if there is a second thief back at the farm finishing Marnie's job. Either way, it's too late to do anything about it now. Who is we? I pull up a chair outside the cell, partly because I want to know, but mostly because I'm tired and I need to sit down. I plop down and look at her expectantly. We're almost eye level with me in the chair. I notice her hair is matted. Her upper arms are incredibly muscular. And her smell finds me even from several feet away.
We, us.
Marnie sits down. Her wrists are still cuffed and her movements are clumsy, and she ends up hitting the ground with a thud. She looks miserable.
I have to get back. She says, I have to get more of those berries, and I have to get back.
Back where? This woman isn't making any sense, and my patience is running out. She looks down at her lap, miserable, tiny, and trapped in a cell. Then she looks back up at me, resolve all over her face. She's going to talk.
I live with my family in the plateaus. It's about a 14-day ride from here. We didn't know how far it was when we started, but that's how long it took for me to get here.
We? Who is this we you keep referring to? I interrupt her.
I was with two others, my friends, from back home. But we were attacked.
Stop. I interrupt her again. Start at the beginning. Why did you leave? How did you survive the Forbidden Zone for that long?
We were starving,
Marnie says and shrugs.
Aren't you running out of food, too?
Yes, but how did you know that?
Sid told me.
You could cut the silence with the knife. You know Sid?
Yes. He was going to meet us, but he was going to join us, and we were going to try to find food. But before we could get here...
Marnie stares down at the ground.
There was a beast one night. We were sleeping. We should have tied ourselves to the trees to sleep, like we were taught. But it was so cold. The wind. So much colder than it is at home. So we set up under a tree and made a fire. We must have fallen asleep, because when I woke up, the beast had torn apart Plume, and it was so giant, so scary. Twice as tall as me, maybe three times, maybe more. I don't know. The fire was almost out. It had thick brown fur and tiny ears, like it feared nothing and never needed to hear danger coming. Its fangs were giant, its nose. It twitched as it passed over me, and I was too afraid to move.
Here she breaks down and starts crying uncontrollably.
Its snout passed right over my face, and then it lunged at my other friend Lorb, and it just started to bite into his chest. It tore him apart right in front of me, and I couldn't move at first. And then when I could, I ran. Lorb was screaming for me, help, but I ran.
There are all kinds of beasts in the Forbidden Zone.
Jacob tries to comfort her. Our berry thief doesn't seem so scary now. But it's possible she's trying to fool us. What about Sid? I ask her, and she looks up at me. Tears streak down her dirty face to reveal puffy, red cheeks underneath.
He was supposed to meet me, but he never showed up. I waited and waited in the woods, but he never came. Then I started to wander, and I found the berries, and it was just filled with food. So much food. I'd never seen so much. And the people back home were starving. All the plants are dying. So I started stealing the bags. I wasn't going to steal many more, just as many as I can carry on my horse. I was going to leave tomorrow and bring back what I could. I don't even want to go north anymore, no matter what the box says.
The box? I'm weary now. This story is coming on a bit strong for someone who has been incarcerated for all of 5 minutes.
The box that we found in a field one day. It's how we talked to Sid. He has one, too.
Had, I correct it. And when Marnie doesn't seem to understand, I add, Sid's dead. Her face falls, and she closes her eyes.
I had a feeling when he didn't come to meet me. He was so sure he wanted to join us.
So what is this box? Marnie shrugs.
It says things, and when you turn the wheel on it, it says other things. Most of it I can't understand. No one where I'm from could understand it. But then, one day it was this man named Sid, and we could understand him. We used to think it was a strange little box of magics, but then Sid started talking to us. When we hit a button, we could talk back. Sid told us that the box had told him that up north there is food. We told him we would come find him, and we would go together and bring food home to everyone. He described the stars at night, and we figured out he was to our east, so we just started riding.
Marnie shrugs, as if to say, hungry people do desperate things. What happened to your so-called box? I'm really trying to keep an open mind. But I can't tell if Marnie is just a complete loon or not. The only thing I don't understand is how she would know Sid if the story weren't true.
It just stopped working one day.
Marnie shrugs.
I don't know why.
Do you still have it? She shakes her head.
It was heavy, so when it stopped working, we left it in the woods. We tried taking it apart and putting it back together, like maybe that would make it work again. But when that didn't work, we just left it.
How convenient. I grumble and get up from my chair.
Look, I say to Marnie, and gesture at her to turn around so I can release her of the cuffs.
I feel bad that your people are starving, but so are ours. So we need to talk amongst ourselves and figure out what to do with you. Because, in the end, you did steal from us. And we can't overlook that. I'm sure you can understand that.
Marnie nods and turns so I can release her wrists, which she rubs together furiously, grimacing. Just as I turn around to command everyone into my office so we can figure out what the hell to do with Marnie, the tiny berry thief, just then, Saley and old Rainier shuffle into the office.
Hello, Sheriff.
I can tell Saley is not happy to be here. Her embarrassment is so visible, I'm embarrassed for her.
Hey, Saley, everything all right?
I try to block their view from our holding cell, and even though I feel bad for Saley, some misplaced item is just not something we need right now.
Well, it so appears that something has gone missing from my dad's house.
Saley smiles, and I can tell she wants to sink into the floorboards.
Is that so?
I say through my teeth.
Yes, it is, apparently.
Well, what is it this time?
The question comes out harsher than I intend, and Saley winces. Sorry. I catch myself. It's just that we have a lot going on right now, and it's not a great time. Saley looks at me with desperation.
But of course, we will take the report and get right on it.
I force a smile.
It's his favorite pair of pants.
Saley is trying not to cringe as she says this.
Someone stole his favorite pair of pants.
I look around the office. Every surface is completely covered with random items from Sid's house. Thankfully, Scully has dutifully started to log them into evidence while I was interrogating our thief. Meanwhile, Jacob and Colin are trying to make room in one of the closets to store all this new evidence, which we don't really have room for. And then, of course, there's our prisoner, adding just one more thing to the utter mess that has become our law office over the last few days. And then, out of nowhere, I hear old Rainier roar at Scully in utter excitement.
Why, young lady, you have found my pot!